Grant, how are you?
Just fine, and I'm glad to hear you're doing well, Jerry.
Yeah, I'm hanging in there. I'm taking 5.5 weeks of chemotherapy and radiation treatments, but others done a little number on my voice, which I think will straighten out.
You sound good.
Surviving most of the time.
You sound good.
Tell me about this book.
Okay, just a little bit of background of the book. The book was actually, we had an earlier version of it published in 1991. It was the first book ever published by MUFON. And it basically, the basic part of it was the investigation of Dr. Eric Walker, who was a former president of Penn State University. And we had, there was about six or seven researchers over a period of 8 years all tried to talk to him and get answers out of him. It was quite evident he knew what was going on. And the book was published, and because it was pre-Amazon.com and pre-Internet and pre-everything, basically it was published by MUFON, but basically you had to be a member of MUFON to get the book. So the book really didn't get any publicity. And then what happened was the reporter from Penn State University went to talk to Dr. Walker about when the book came out and said, you know, this stuff's been written about you. And for the first time in 8 years, he hung up the phone. He said, you know, I deny everything that's in it, and I'm busy, and I got to go. And he hung up the phone. And so I asked Scott Crane, who co-authored the book with me, I said, because he's right at Penn State, I said, well, when's the reporter going back? And he said, well, she's not. She was so intimidated by him that they were afraid to talk to this guy. So the book sort of died. And then at that point, I was so sort of down on ufology that I sort of pulled out of ufology for a number of years, sort of worked with my son. My son was a pretty good hockey player and spent most of my time trying to, you know, drive him around to practices and, you know, tours and stuff like this. And so what happened was Richard Dolan saw the material that was in the book. And in his UFO's national security state, he put some of the material, the stuff from the Canadian government, the early 1950s that starts the book, the Dr. Eric Walker, the Dr. Robert Sarbacher story, he put it in his book, and then he approached me to republish the book. And what I did, Scott Crane had written the original version based on my research, but Scott hadn't been involved in UFOs for a number of years, so what I did is I sort of updated the book with all the latest stuff on MJ-12, which is a big part of the book, Area 51, the Dr. Eric Walker story. There were some things that happened after the book was published, and put all that in the book. And it actually took a couple of years from when we first started redrafting the book till it finally came out. In fact, at the very end, there was just piles of material. I was going back and forth to Richard. Okay, change this. We're putting another chapter in here. And it finally got out, I guess it was last week. And it's doing fairly well. And it sort of details the U.S. government cover-up based upon my investigation, which started with the sightings. And then when I sort of gave up on the sightings from the flap that I was involved in, I started to research the Canadian government. So the book details what the Canadian government knew in the early 1950s and how that led to Dr. Eric Walker and how that led to the presidents. And because we did the book in 1991, the Area 51 story was breaking at that time. So we were in charge. I was in touch with Goodman, who you mentioned, George Knapp, John Lear provided a lot of material over the years to me as to his involvement in the story. And so we've updated, I guess there's about 100 pages that are sort of new from the original book. And it's all out, and it basically details my version of the U.S. government cover-up. And what I importantly think is going on is this gradual disclosure thing where they're sort of dropping material into the UFO field.
Now it sounds to me like this is a great read, and you kind of underplayed 100 new pages. So people can go over to Amazon and get that book, right?
Yes, they can go to Amazon. I have a link at presidentialufo.com, which has the links to the whether it's Europe or Amazon in the States. And I also have a link there for if they want an autograph copy. Right at the end of all the links, there's an address where they can write, and I can provide them an autograph copy.
Well, that's a better deal anyway. Get Grant's... signature, go to your website. Let's talk a little bit about a new material. Anything jump out at you, Stan, that you, as you're researching and adding new material that you didn't know or suspected?
Okay, there's a couple of things. I guess I'll start with the Walker thing. There's a couple of new things that we added there. We detail the whole conversations that dealt with Walker, and how the Walker story started was the MJ-12 documents. For a lot of your listeners may not have been around like you and I back in the 80s when this UFO thing was all going on. And they don't realize that in the late 80s, there was a lot of really weird stuff going on. There was these MJ-12 documents that were released by Bill Moore and Jamie Chandray and Stanton Friedman. And there was this big documentary called UFO Cover-Up Live, which I talk quite a bit about in the book, and I should have done more because I now fully believe this was very clearly a CIA operation. And I don't know if you remember this documentary. If you go to YouTube, you can actually watch the full documentary. They have it there. It was called UFO Cover-Up Live. And this I added a lot of material on that. We already knew when the documentary took place that it was sort of a way of dropping material into the UFO field. And it sort of detailed the Falcon and the Condor. It introduced these two guys, and they were supposedly high-level government people. And Bill Moore was in charge of these guys, and he had given these guys bird names, and there was a whole bunch of them. And so what we sort of added to that was the fact that, if you recall, Bob Emmenegger was involved in this show. He was involved, and he told the story of the Holloman Air Force Base filming on the show, and the Russians were linked in live. There was all sorts of really bizarre things going on there. And so when I rewrote the book, I added the part that the CIA said to Bob Emmenegger that they were going to stand down. Bob warned them that there was going to be a guy on this documentary who was claiming to be a high-level intelligence agent. He was going to tell the story about the cover-up. And the CIA agent that had been on the set when UFOs, Past, Present, and Future, the documentary that Emmenegger did in the 1970s, this agent was on the set the entire time they did this documentary. And he said that the CIA would stand down. They wouldn't do anything. And what we reveal in the book is we reveal that the very next day after this documentary took place, there was a major meeting took place at the CIA headquarters in the office of the counterintelligence office. And your friend and mine, Ronald Pendolfi, was in the meeting. He's the guy who supposedly runs the weird desk. All the UFO files at the CIA has been identified as the top scientist in the CIA by the New York Times in 1996. Kit Green, who had the CIA weird desk UFO files before Pendolfi was in the meeting. Richard Weaver, who wrote the Roswell report for the Clinton administration that basically came up with the idea that it was the Mogul balloon and dropping the dummies. He was in this meeting. And Hennessy, who Colonel Hennessy, who was in charge of all the security for all the black budget Air Force programs, the stealth fighters, stealth bomber, all those programs, he was in the meeting. And they have this discussion the day after this documentary takes place about what happened at the documentary. I detail that. So we added that, and we also added with Dr. Eric Walker. After the book came out, we had Stanton Friedman had done an interview with him, and this was, I think, in 1991. Stanton did an interview with him, and Walker told Stanton, he said, "Well, you know, I haven't been involved in this for 25 years," and then really didn't say much after that. And when I sort of detailed it back, 1991 took off 25 years, or 1990, 25 years, it came to 1965. And in 1965 was the famous Kecksburg crash, which in the first book we sort of talked about the Kecksburg crash. And it sort of made sense. He said, I haven't been involved for 25 years. So I got the main researcher in England who had been doing most of the research and most of the interviews with Walker. And Walker already knew the book had come out. And so he phoned up Walker, and he said, Dr. Walker, I've got another question for you, and I don't know if you can really answer it. I just wanted to know whether you were at Kecksburg, Pennsylvania in 1965, without mentioning UFOs or anything. And Walker basically said, yeah, I was there with two military people, but they were off duty. And so we put that interview. This it's not a long interview, but he does talk about being at the Kecksburg crash and not wanting to identify what it was, refuses to talk about it, but confirms he was there. So we add that. I added quite a bit to the MJ-12 document because the MJ-12 document has sort of been thrown under the bus by vast majority of ufologists. And I always knew that MJ-12 was for real. The reason that we knew it was because when the MJ-12 document was released in 1987, this is when the first interview took place with Dr. Eric Walker. It was done by Bill Steinman, who was a researcher in California who has been out of the field for 20 years. He found out about this. He had the MJ-12 document was released, and he phoned up Dr. Walker because Walker had been squealed on by a scientist in Washington by the name of Dr. Robert Seibacher, who was a sort of a military advisor to various military units on scientific matters. And he had been invited to a set of briefings at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, said that he couldn't go, but he was in an office in Washington, D.C., in the Navy office, and a number of the scientists who had been at these crash saucer briefings at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in 1950 had been there. And so Stanton interviewed him, and he said, well, who was there? And he said, well, Wernher von Braun was there, von Neumann was there, Dr. von Neumann, who was the guy who sort of is the guy who invented the computer back how the computer started back in the late 40s, and Vannevar Bush. And Stanton said to him, he said, well, you know, isn't there someone who might still be alive? And he said, well, yeah, there was this guy, he was from Pennsylvania, he was really arrogant. He was at all the meetings. He thought he knew everything. And research was done by Steinman. He came up with Walker's name, phoned up Dr. Robert Seibacher, and said, was it Dr. Eric Walker? And he said, yeah, that was the guy. That was the guy. He was at all the meetings. So Steinman has this MJ-12 document, and this is only days after it was released in Washington at the MUFON conference when it was made public. And he phoned up Walker, and he said, Dr. Walker, I understand from Dr. Robert Seibacher that you were at a set of briefings dealing with a crash flying saucer and alien bodies at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And Walker said, yeah, I was there, so what? And so Steinman sort of freaks out. He says, I mean, this is the most important subject. What do you mean, so what? And he starts to argue with Walker. And he said, I've got this document, and it's MJ-12 document. And Walker said, and this is 1987, this interview took place. Walker cuts him off, and he says, I've known of them for 40 years. Leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. You're up against the windmills. And so without identifying the fact that this was a group that controlled the UFO subject, Walker said, I've known of them, MJ-12, for 40 years. So you go back, it's 1947, which coincided with the document. Now, later on, when shown the document, when mailed the document, Walker said he believed it was a hoax. And I do believe that it's not the legitimate document. It's been changed. But it does have the basic core material that was in there. So we had Walker confirming right from the word go that MJ-12 was real, that there was a group. And we had a woman who, shortly after we started the book, had some relationship to Scott Crane, knew her in Pennsylvania. He was talking to her, and she said that she had been part of a debriefing team in Okinawa at an Air Force base there in a general's office. And a four-person debrief team that was going in, and what they do is they go into the vault and they clear out documents, and they destroy documents, burn documents and stuff. And she claimed that in behind a filing cabinet, behind a drawer, they had come across this document. And she said she can't confirm 100% whether it was the MJ-12 document, but it was very close. And they were told to destroy it. They destroyed the document. After the book came out, she was transferred. She ran it. She got into a lot of trouble because I guess they could identify who this person was because, you know, you can go which general, which we mentioned the year that this had happened when they found this document. And so we had this contact that had confirmed MJ-12, and that a lot of people, when we put the book out, nobody ever asked us about this woman, and we knew that she was a legitimate. We knew who she was. She was, you know, had no interest in UFOs, just had come across this document. So in the book, we detail a lot of new stuff, and it's some of the most powerful stuff on MJ-12 for people who don't believe MJ-12 is for real. We produced three letters in there from John Andrews, who was one of the most prominent aerospace people in private industry, and he was very interested in black budget programs. He wrote a lot of articles for aviation magazines and stuff like that. And we produced three articles that were written by John Andrews in 1987. He writes one to Lee Graham, who was the he had a security clearance. He worked for Aerojet, an aerospace company in California. And his job was that Bill Moore, every document that Bill Moore got from his Falcon, his secret government sources, he would give it to Lee Graham, and Lee Graham would take it to work and hand it into his security officers, which would initiate an investigation. And what they were trying to do is get some reaction from the government about this, about these different documents. One of these letters was written to Lee Graham. One was written to Ben Rich, who ran Skunk Works. And one of the letters was written to Ron Ruger, who also worked at Aerojet, who had worked on satellites and was involved in these incident where satellites were tracking UFOs. And he wrote a number of articles from UFON and lectured on this whole satellite that was picking up UFOs coming in to the Earth's atmosphere. So these are the three people I wrote the letter to. And in that letter, 1987, a lot of people will say, Bill Moore hoaxed the document, he came up with it. And in these three letters, John Andrews, this aviation guy, states quite clearly that he had known about MJ-12 for a number of years, long before Bill Moore ever released that document, and he even stated that it was an NSA-related operation that he was aware of in Turkey. And what they were doing is they were tracking stuff along the Russian border, Russian planes, all this kind of stuff, figuring out what's going on in the Soviet Union, and this NSA facility in Turkey was picking up UFOs. And they were sending the material that they were getting to an MJ-12 group at the NSA facility in Kelly Air Force Base in Texas. And we did the check, and sure enough, there is an NSA facility at Kelly Air Force Base in Texas. So we add this. We add, there's about 12 different things on MJ-12 that we sort of add that show that it's quite clear that there was an MJ-12 group, and that a lot of it is leaks. For example, there's a very sort of a very weird story that probably isn't really well known in the UFO community as well. You probably know that James Bamford, who is the most prominent writer in the United States, he writes on the NSA. He wrote The Puzzle Palace. He wrote a book in 2008, and there's a story that deals with an admiral, his name escapes me right at the moment, in 2006 had become the intelligence director for the president, for President Bush. And this was over top of the CIA. And the rumored story was that he was a disclosure guy, and he started to make this movement, and he formerly had headed the NSA, and he became the National Security Advisor to President Bush. So anyway, in 2008, Bamford releases a book. It's got Shadow in the name. I can't remember the name of the book. And Gary Beckman was the first guy to pick this up. He writes me and he says, have you seen the cover of James Bamford's book? And he said, it's got top secret MJ-12 on it. And I said, yeah, I couldn't believe it. And so I went and checked. I actually went running down to the bookstore. I actually bought this book. And if you look at the book, and we reproduce this, the cover of this book in in our book, and you can see it, and it's sort of, it's not directly, you can sort of see it on the side of the front cover, and it's sort of woven into the cover that if you just looked at the book, you wouldn't see it. But if you look carefully, you can see this top secret MJ-12 on the side of the front cover. And so, of course, the obvious question is, well, why is MJ-12, what's it doing on this very, very prominent, he's the most prominent guy writing on the NSA. And so it seemed to tie into this guy who was the NSA guy who had taken over the National Intelligence Director, and he was supposed to be a disclosure guy, and suddenly this appears on the book. So James Bamford was actually asked about this and said, what is MJ-12 doing on the front cover of your book? And he said, I have no idea. So these are the kind of things, and this is where I say that they're dropping this kind of material into the UFO community. They're sort of playing with us, similar to last year when, and we do a whole chapter on this at the end. I do sort of an appendix chapter on Chase Brandon, this whole Chase Brandon story, that here's this guy 35 years with the CIA, and then 6 years under contract for 10 years, the second most powerful spokesman for the CIA, suddenly pops up on Coast to Coast and says, oh, by the way, I saw a box called with a Roswell on it, and it confirms, I looked inside, and I'm not going to tell you what was inside, but it confirms that Roswell was real, there was alien bodies, and he just sort of pops out of nowhere. And when we questioned the CIA, and when Billy Cox went after the CIA, the reporter, they basically said, we have no evidence that confirms his story, and we're not talking about it anymore, and that was the end of that. And for me, the point is that a guy like that does not come out and put the CIA in a position where he's going to say they lied about Roswell, they're back in the UFO business. This was a job that had to be approved by the CIA, by the CIA director, and the CIA director works for the president, therefore the president knew. And so there is still this, even up to today, and it's been going on since Disney first did his documentary in the mid-1950s and was promised a UFO film. He was told to do a documentary to help acclimatize the American people. He'd be given this film. At the end, they pull out the film. And so what they've done over the years is they've done all these, dropped this kind of stuff, documents that aren't real, but that have quite a bit of material in them. The Serpo stuff, which is like total nonsense, except that it's got classified material in it, and somebody is getting parts of the story out through the Serpo story and putting it through people like Richard Doty, who nobody believes, putting it through people like Dan Smith, who really nobody believes, or using Bob Lazar, who had a bad background. And the material is coming through these people, and what happens in the UFO community is that the UFO story gets out, everybody looks. They find something wrong with the story, for example, Bob Lazar not having the proper education that he's claiming. Everybody says, oh, it's a hoax, and everybody runs off, and the story gets out, and everybody thinks it's a hoax, and the basic core story is getting out, and at the same time, they're able to maintain the classified aspects of the program that they want. They can't come with full disclosure, because you're going to... You have to give up all the technological material you have, all the mind control stuff that they're picking up out of this. So you want the story out, but you want to keep the classified aspects of the story going.
You did a whole litany of the close encounters, is what I would call it, of disclosure. And we almost had it several times, including that Disney project.
Yeah, there was actually Richard Dolan. We detailed it a little bit in our book. Richard Dolan, if you read UFOs National Security State Volume 2, he talks about an initiative in 1991. And I think Robert Collins also talks about it in his book, where they were days away from Bush going disclosure in 1991, August of 1991, and it was kind of an involved story. They were waiting for Robert Gates to be confirmed. They were going to brief him at Kennebunkport, which was his sort of home away from Washington, Bush Sr., and they almost disclosed there. And I can't really prove this, but there is this sort of always a story inside ufology that there's a split inside the control group, whether it's called MJ-12 or whatever it is, that some people want it out, some people don't want it out, and so they've gone to this sort of half position where they're sort of dropping this material to give us the idea that yes, there's been a crash, they have recovered bodies, there was three live aliens, they were visitors of the United States of America, like ambassadors to the United States of America, that they had this crystal, the aliens had this crystal that I talk about in the book, where you're able to look into the crystal and see events in the past, that they could show you the crucifixion of Jesus Christ in this crystal, and all these bizarre things that you read them and you say, this is like total fiction. And yet if you listen to people like Kit Green or people like Robert Collins, people who have sort of been in the inside, they're basically saying some of this material is true. And what it basically comes down to, it's the way if Jerry Pippen sort of like you had a secret life and you saved the United States of America from the Russians or whatever, and you now want to tell your story, and you go to the CIA and say, okay, I want to tell my story about how I saved America, they'll say, okay, Jerry, you can do it, but here's what you got to do. Same as Chase Brannon. He takes his book twice to a review panel at the CIA, and they say, okay, Jerry, you got to change these names. You got to change these dates. You got to change this around so people can identify the place. And you tell a fictionalized version of how you saved the United States of America. And that's what they're doing. This is a fictionalized version of the UFO story that's being told. And at the same time, they don't spill the milk, because once you spill the milk, you can't put it back in the glass. That's the whole point.
Now, when we talk about Majestic, it doesn't exist now, does it? Or have a different name or what?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Stephen Greer came out with, it was called PI-40 or something. Usually when a name of a program gets leaked, they immediately change the name. So I don't imagine it's the same thing. It's almost like I tell a story, and I think I tell it in the book, about Ronald Pandolfi. Ronald Pandolfi is very proud of the fact that he's the guy that shut the remote viewing program down in 1995. And yet everybody knows the remote viewing program was doing very good. Otherwise, you wouldn't get funded every year. You would have to keep producing very good results, otherwise nobody would find you. So it went on until 1995, and the story behind that was the reason they shut it down, and it was at DIA, and Pandolfi was fighting to get this out of DIA back to CIA so he could shut it down, and the DIA people who were in control of the remote viewing program kept him off the distribution list because they knew what he was trying to do. Eventually, he went to Congress, congressional people. Congress moved it back to the CIA, and they immediately killed the program. And the reason I say they killed the program was because it had started to leak. Jim Mars, a lot of people don't know this, Jim Mars in 1994 was going to release a book on the remote viewing program, and he had all the names, he had all the stories, and he was going to release the book. And Jim Mars tells a story, if you've ever interviewed him, you should ask him about this, he tells a story about how suddenly he couldn't talk to his editor, it just went, he couldn't publish the book. And he didn't actually publish this book till 2000, till almost like 6 years later. And the thing was, the story was leaking, and if Jim Mars had got the book out, the CIA would have been in the position of having an active program on remote viewing. And then you can't say it doesn't work, because they'll say, well, you're running the program. So what you do is you kill the program, say it didn't work, and then let the book come out. Because you can't kill a program once, you know, it's exposed. So that's what they did. And all they did, according to Gary Beckham, people who I think are kind of expert at this area, all they did was take the program from the CIA, the remote viewing program, and move it to the NSA, made it deeper black, change the name, move it. And there's a number of cases. There's even, I think, some of the remote viewing people who are running it talked about Jimmy Carter making a leak early in the program when it was called Grill Flame. And at that point, they had to change the name because Carter had talked about it. So this is what they do: is every time it's you get a compromised position in a program, you change the name, move it deeper black, move it to a different agency so people can't track it. There is a control group, what it's called, but there definitely is a control group that is running this whole show.
When we talk about disclosure, in many ways, we've had it, and nobody's paying any attention, you know, because we've got all these details that are obfuscated one way or the other, and you get two or three different versions, and after a while, most people just kind of give up, you know what I mean? I guess that's their strategy.
Yeah, that's exactly, and especially in the UFO community, because, and I've said it, and some people get upset, but I always say that the UFO community is sort of waiting for a messiah. They're waiting for someone to come who has all the answers. They're waiting for the ultimate UFO case. They're waiting for the case, you know, where the UFO lands on the White House lawn or there's a crash that the government can't cover up. And everybody's always looking for the new story. So what happens is that when a story comes out, it looks big, and you get this real rush of news. For example, the Chase Brannon story. When Lee Spiegel put it out, within the first couple of days of that story on Huffington Post, he got 1.5 million hits. And everybody was watching the story, but it just sort of faded away. And because there's always a problem with the story, and the UFO community will say, okay, that's not the messiah. That's not the story we're looking for. It's a hoax. give up on it, and let's look for the next case. So in the UFO community, unfortunately, we're always looking for the next story that doesn't have any problems. So it's very easy to feed this stuff into the UFO community, knowing that, for example, like Bob Lazar, you put him on the base, knowing that he doesn't have the proper credentials and that he's going to get exposed when he walks out. He walks out, and then people find out he doesn't have two master's degrees like he claimed he did, and suddenly the whole story just blows up and everybody walks away. And the problem with the problem that they had with the Area 51 story, like the Chase Brannon story, died within a couple of days. The Area 51 story just took off. They couldn't stop it. And the reason for that was that George Knapp was behind the story. Most reporters, and you and I have talked about this before, most reporters, you do the story, like Lee Spiegel, you put the story out, and like 2 days later, 4 o'clock deadline, you got to do another story. So you haven't got time to go and get it more in-depth interviews, get to the bottom of the whole thing. And so you go on to the next story, and the story just dies. George Knapp spent 6 to 8 months investigating the Area 51 story, and that's why they couldn't kill it. It just kept going, and he had specials, and everybody was picking it up. And then Goodman was taking buses up to Area 51, and it just sort of spiraled out of control, and they had to move the S-4 facility. They had to get it out of there. They had to stop test flying this stuff, and they had to grab all the land. I think it was in 1995. They actually grabbed thousands more acres around because people were going up into the mountains and looking down over Area 51, and now all your programs are exposed. Everybody's watching everything you're doing, and it's all backfired. So they grabbed the land so that you have to be like 26 miles away to see what's going on, and nobody can see anything. And it took them years to get it back under control because they didn't realize that George Knapp would be given the authorization to go after this story. And in the book, we detail the fact a lot of people don't know about the Area 51 story. They just look at the fact that, like Stanton always brings up, Stanton Friedman, and it's true. I mean, that there's something wrong with Lazar's background. And I always say it's totally irrelevant what background he had, whether he had no degrees or whether he had 20 doctorate degrees. It really doesn't matter. The only thing that's really relevant with Bob Lazar is, did they put him on the test site? Bob and George Knapp, a lot of people don't know, had over 24 other witnesses that basically corroborated the story that Bob Lazar was telling. In fact, he has the one witness that we detail. We don't tell the whole story, but we tell most of the story, where Knapp talks about the one witness that he says Bob Lazar may have trouble with his background, but this guy is absolutely flawless. I tracked this guy down. I found this guy. He went after this guy who had been at the test site since the 1950s. And George Knapp said, if this story is true about the saucers on there, this guy's going to know about it. So George Knapp sort of makes friends with this guy. He goes to events where this guy's at, sort of introduces himself, and generally becomes friends with this guy, not talking UFOs or anything. And then the guy takes him to his house, and he's going to talk about the test site and the atomic testing they had done there. And George Knapp tells the story. He gets to this guy's place, and the guy says to him, opens the book, and he says, you didn't come here to talk about nuclear tests, did you? And George says, no, not really. He said, you want to talk about UFOs, don't you? And George Knapp says, yeah. And then George said it took 6 months to get the story out of this guy. He went for lunch, went for breakfast with this guy, and he was not allowed to tape anything, not allowed to take notes while he was talking to this guy, and would run out of the meetings and quickly write down what the guy had told him. And over a six-month period, this guy told him the whole thing's true. They had the craft. They were working on the craft. Not only that, they had a live alien. And he told George this story. And George is saying, like, this guy, if you knew who this guy was, he's absolutely the real deal. And said that they were afraid the alien was going to get off Area 51 base. They were afraid. They weren't afraid of the story leaking. They were afraid of this alien getting loose. And so this is the part of the stuff we put into the Area 51 story that people don't know. They just all people know is that Bob Lazar had something wrong with his background. They don't know that George Knapp had six witnesses who, one of them, for example, one woman who worked in the court system there, who he had found out about, had actually worked for a military contractor and was involved in meetings when the material was moved from the Blue Room at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and moved in the early 1980s, was moved to Area 51. She was involved in these meetings. George said, I'd like to have an interview. He's going to put her on camera. And she said, okay, fine. The very morning she was supposed to go on camera, she gets a visit from two guys in suits, and they say, we just want to remind you, you're under a security oath. We know you go visit your daughter in Los Angeles quite often. We'd hate to have you have an accident in the desert. And she, George says to this day, she will not talk to him. He had six witnesses back to back, and he said there was no doubt that he, that they were watching what he was doing, that phone tap, however they did it, and that six of these witnesses all got visits and wouldn't talk to him. And so people don't know that part of the story. And the other part of the story that we tell, which is a new development, and I've written it up in a, I think we may have talked about it before, was that the whole notion of what happened was that everybody thinks, well, Bob Lazar had this, you know, background, they put him there. What people don't realize is that when this, before this whole thing started, and you and I were around in the 80s, you know John Lear, I know John Lear. In the 1980s, in 1988, when this story broke, or 89, when Lazar first went on camera, John Lear was the state director for MUFON for Nevada.